Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is March 8th, Monday. We're going to finish the introduction to muscles chapter and then actually start talking about some muscles in the body, but still we want to talk about how they function a little bit. And let's see, what else is happening this week? Yeah, you got some exams. You got some people still have practicum 2 to take. And then you also have an exam on Wednesday in here, a lecture exam, right? And the chapters, what chapters are on exam 2? 6, 7, 8, and 9, 4 chapters. 6, bones and skeletal tissue, axial skeleton is 7, appendicular skeleton is 8, and then joints is chapter 9. So those chapters. So you need a Scantron, a good eraser, and a pencil, and then a Cypress College or Fullerton College picture ID, right? And then you're good. All right, so that is next time on Wednesday, so be here early on Wednesday. All right, so last time we started talking about muscle, and we were talking about the connective tissue sheets around muscle, and I think I showed you this picture previously, right? So here's the whole muscle. This is an organ, right? So hold on, you guys. I know you guys need to talk, but I'm going to run out of voice if I have to speak over you, so hold on. See me after class. All right, so the connective tissue sheaths are the epimysium that's on top of the whole muscle organ, and then we see that there is fine structure in the organ, namely there are bundles. But commonly, what do we call all these bundles of?
Fibers.
Okay, fibers, that's close, but not quite. All right, so you have the whole muscle. What's the next smallest division? Fascicles, yeah, the bundles are fascicles. And then making up a fascicle could be hundreds of muscle fibers that you have right here, right? So you got the muscle organ, you got fascicles, and then muscle fibers that make up the fascicles. And the connective tissue sheath around the whole organ is called the epimysium. Around a fascicle is called the endomysium. Perimysium. Right, and then around each muscle cell is called the endomysium. So the latest edition of your book is pretty good because it shows these things in a little bit different orientation. There's a nice table, table 10.1, right, that shows the epimysium around the whole muscle organ, and then here's the fascicle, okay, and the perimysium surrounds a fascicle, and then every fascicle has hundreds of muscle fibers in it, and surrounding every muscle cell or fiber is the epimysium. How come it doesn't say that here? I'm sorry, endomysium. Doesn't say endomysium here. Endo. Okay, so this is a good picture to look at. All right, then we started talking about how a muscle is organized inside of a fiber or a muscle cell. And we talked about the organelle for contraction. What's the organelle for contraction?
Sarcomere.
Well, the sarcomere, yeah, I want to get to sarcomere in just a second, but in the way that I think, all right, give me an example of an organelle inside of a cell.
Mitochondria.
What's the function of that?
ATP.
Yeah, make energy, to make ATP. Give me another name of an organelle.
Endoplasmic reticulum.
What the heck does that do? Okay, if it's rough endoplasmic reticulum, it can make proteins. If it's smooth endoplasmic reticulum, remember it makes lipids or it stores calcium ions. So every organelle has a particular function. So the organelle that specifically functions in contraction, right, is called a, we see it right here. Oh, let me get this working like this. That is a myofibril. That's the organelle for contraction. And so every muscle cell has hundreds of myofibrils that make it up. All right. Furthermore, you can break a myofibril down into myofilaments that we see right here. And we looked at the two kinds. The two major kinds of myofilaments are the thin ones and the thick ones. What's the thin one?
Actin.
And the thick one is myosin. That's right. Okay, but to understand how these proteins of contraction work together, right, we see this repeating unit over and over and over and over again. within a myofibril, from the beginning of the muscle to the end. And this is what we call the sarcomere. And the sarcomere shows how these myofilaments are arranged. All right, so what's the structural and functional unit of contraction? That is the sarcomere, right? So the organelle is the myofibril. Making up myofibrils are sarcomeres lined up from end to end, and that's the structural and functional unit of contraction. All right, so which ones of these proteins here actually shorten when a muscle contracts? Is it the actin or the myosin, or do they both shorten? You're shaking your head like, I don't know what I'm talking about. Well, straighten me out. How does a sarcomere shorten? Yeah, they slide past each other. So we call that the sliding filament mechanism. Okay, so here is that thick filament. You can see these head groups right here. When the muscle is told to contract, these myosin head groups can grab an actin and they pull on the actin, and these actin molecules slide toward the center of the sarcomere. I've got a nice video that I'm going to show you how that works in just a little bit. Okay. So that's pretty good. So let me find something right here. Maybe I'm going to go to this one. All right. So how do we control skeletal muscle? All right, so here we see a whole muscle organ. What are these bundles right here called? Those are fascicles. And then making up fascicles are all these different muscle fibers or muscle cells. And inside these muscle cells we have the myofibrils. And what's making up these myofibrils right in here? Yeah, sarcomeres. And what are the things that make up the sarcomere, the contractile proteins? Actin and myosin, we call those myofilaments, right? So you should be able to go up and down, kind of like playing a music scale or something, know the building blocks of each of those different elements. Like the smallest things that we see right here are the myofilaments. We put a bunch of myofilaments together, we get myofibrils. We put a bunch of myofibrils together, we get a muscle fiber. And if we put a bunch of muscle fibers together, we get a fascicle. And if we put a bunch of fascicles together, we get the whole muscle organ, right? So that's how you should think about that. All right, now skeletal muscle, what kind of control is skeletal muscle under? Yeah, as opposed to other kinds of muscle which are involuntary, like cardiac and smooth muscle, involuntary, you can't consciously control that. But skeletal muscle you can, because it has nerve fibers coming from your central nervous system. So spinal cord, here we see a nerve fiber that's going to bring an electrical signal down to this particular muscle organ, right? But notice that some muscle fiber or some nerve fibers might innervate one muscle cell, or this one right here. How many muscle cells does this blue one innervate? Just two, all right? And here we see a different nerve fiber. How many muscle cells is this one? You see, it actually goes to three different muscle cells. So if there is an electrical impulse just on the blue nerve fiber right here, that produces a relatively weak contraction. But if you're anticipating to do a little bit heavier kind of exercise, maybe your central nervous system decides to send an electrical impulse down this red motor neuron, in which case, how many muscle cells contract? Three. Is that going to be stronger or weaker or the same compared to two? Oh, stronger. It's going to be actually a lot stronger, 50% stronger, right, from 2 to 3. And if you even need more strength to lift something that's heavy, guess what your central nervous system decides? Well, let's send an electrical signal down the red and the blue, right, to make the contraction even stronger yet. So skeletal muscles can recruit different numbers of muscle cells to contract to pick up different loads, for instance. All right, so here is an important concept. We call a motor neuron and all the muscle cells that it stimulates into contraction a motor unit. So there are different motor units depending on what kind of activities are necessary. So if you have a part of your body that has very fine discriminative control, all right, like maybe your lips or your hands where you have to speak, you have to use language or a fine dexterity with your fingertips, right, you have many motor units, and a motor unit is going to have just a few muscle fibers attached to it. But other places in your body where you don't need a lot of manipulation or fine control, you might have a motor neuron going to hundreds and hundreds of muscle fibers. For instance, like your back muscles, because we don't use our back muscles for anything other than maintaining posture, right? We're not manipulating, we're not speaking with our back muscles. That's a very coarse kind of control. All right, so I do want you to know what a motor unit is. It's a motor neuron, and we can see one coming from the spinal cord going all the way to the skeletal muscle cell, causing this muscle to contract. All right, and that's under voluntary control. So now we have that electrical signal coming down to this area right here. This is a special kind of synapse. It's going to stimulate this skeletal muscle to contract. All right, and this is what we call the neuromuscular junction. All right, so it's a special kind of synapse. So this neuromuscular junction takes an electrical signal from the motor neuron, changes it to a chemical signal that goes across the synapse, and then that starts another electrical signal in the skeletal muscle cell right here. So the neuromuscular junction is an example of a chemical synapse. All right, so actually I want you to know the synapse as being the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. So let's just review a couple structural and functional units of structural and functional units in anatomy. What's the structural and functional unit of life?
A cell.
What's the structural and functional unit of compact bone? Osteon. What's the structural and functional unit of contraction? Sarcomere. Yeah, you guys are doing pretty good. All right, and what's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? So cells can communicate with each other. That's the synapse. All right, so we're going to actually look at a synapse today. As a matter of fact, maybe right now. Let's look and see what we know about this neuromuscular junction right here. Okay. Let me get some of these out of the way. All right, so here is the neuromuscular junction. So we zoomed way into that thing that kind of looked like a foot standing on top of the muscle cell. So here is the motor neuron, and the tip of a motor neuron is what we call an axon terminal. And inside the axon terminal, there are vesicles that contain that chemical signal that's going to stimulate the muscle into contracting. And so that chemical signal is going to be transmitted to the muscle cell right here. And since it's coming from a neuron, guess what we call the general name for that chemical signal that goes from a neuron to the muscle? It's going to be transmitting a signal to the muscle. We call it a neurotransmitter. Right, a neurotransmitter is something that's secreted by a neuron that can stimulate this muscle into contracting. And in particular, the neurotransmitter that is always used at the neuromuscular junction is a chemical called acetylcholine. So these vesicles, which we call synaptic vesicles, contain the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, and they're stored in the axon terminus until there is an electrical signal coming down the motor neuron. And when there is an electrical signal coming down to the axon terminus, that allows a calcium ion to enter this, sometimes we call this a synaptic button or axon terminus or Bouton terminale. Goes by a bunch of different names, but it's a little swelling at the end of this axon right here because it contains mitochondria that are making ATP, all of these synaptic vesicles. So when calcium enters the axon terminus right here, that causes the fusion of the synaptic vesicle with the presynaptic membrane, and that releases acetylcholine into the space between the cells right here, and we call that the synaptic cleft. And because there's a space, that electrical signal can't jump from one cell to another. That information has to be transmitted as a chemical signal, which we call the neurotransmitter. And then when the neurotransmitter moves across the synaptic cleft, it binds to the muscle membrane right here, and that starts up another electrical signal that flows over the cell membrane of the muscle cell, and we're going to see how that causes the muscle to contract. Okay, so in order for this neuron to communicate with this muscle cell right here, there has to be a special ion that enters that causes the release of the signaling molecule. What ion has to enter the neuron in order for the neuron to communicate with the muscle cell? What ion is that? It is, yeah, calcium. Okay, and I call that an ion because it has this a little electrical charge. That's what an ion is. All right, so where else have you run into calcium before that was important to have in your body?
Bone.
Yeah, in order to make bones strong, it has to have calcium. All right, but now here we see that in order for your nervous system to communicate with muscles, where else do you need calcium? Outside, yeah, outside the cells in the extracellular space. All right, so I might ask you, where is it more important for you if you're going to pick, where, if you were maybe a little bit low on calcium, where would you put calcium? Would you put calcium in the extracellular space so that you could control skeletal muscle, or would you make bones strong? Okay, probably, right? You would like to have it in the extracellular space because in order for you to breathe, right, you need that diaphragm to contract. You need to contract muscles. All right, and so that's one of the underlying fundamental problems with osteoporosis, right? That you kind of agree with your body. If you're running low on calcium, right, where are you going to, who are you going to shortchange? Communication between cells or your bones? You would pick your bones as well, okay? That's just kind of an unfortunate circumstance. All right, well, what do I see right here? I see the zigzag line here and the zigzag line over here. What are these little zigzag lines? Yeah, those are the Z discs. So from here to here is a, what is from this Z disc to this Z disc right here? That's a sarcomere, right? And then I see this thick filament, which is myosin, and this thin filament right here, which is actin. Okay. All right, so now let's talk about another exam figure. Here's another really good exam figure. All right, so we see that there is an electrical signal that develops on the cell membrane of the muscle cell, and it flows over the muscle cell. And that electrical signal is going to cause the actin and myosin to slide over each other, thereby contracting the sarcomere. All right, but that electrical signal has to get down deep inside the muscle cell. So here is a special electrical tube that allows that electrical signal to get deep down inside a muscle cell. All right, and where is that at? Here is another exam figure. Ah, here it is, right here. All right, so now we've kind of zoomed out. Here we see not just one myofibril, but a number of myofibrils. And on the ends, we can see what? The actin and the myosin filaments right here. And I don't see the neuromuscular junction anymore, but I see that I see this electrical tunnel that can take the electrical signal from the cell membrane or the sarcolemma deep inside the cell. All right, so this is what we call a transverse tubule because it's transverse to the long axis of the muscle cell. And as that electrical signal goes down and surrounds every myofibril, it passes by this organelle right here that's this blue color. Or is it purple? It's blue. Oh, I heard purple too. Okay, I guess I'm not the only person that has trouble with color. Well, it's a blue-purple kind of color, I guess. Okay. And as that electrical signal passes by this system of membranes right here, which is really smooth endoplasmic reticulum, but in a muscle, we call that the sarcoplasmic reticulum, all right, that causes the release of even more calcium because the job of smooth endoplasmic reticulum in muscle is to store calcium. So that electrical signal from the T-tubule causes a big rush of calcium throughout the whole myofibril right here. All right, so we saw that calcium is not only important for making bones strong, it's not only important for synaptic transmission so that nerves can communicate with muscles, right? But calcium is also important for, what else? For controlling the sliding of actin and myosin over each other. So the basic mechanism of muscle contraction, calcium is necessary for as well. All right, so about the last place that you need to have proper levels of calcium is in your bones. It's much more important for cells to communicate with each other, for muscle to be able to contract, than to have strong bones. All right, so I could ask you a question. What organelle inside of a muscle cell stores calcium? The sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, so the answer on the test wouldn't be like the blue organelle or the purple organelle right here. You'd have to say what? Sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is basically the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, so that is what we call excitation-contraction coupling. When there's an electrical signal on the muscle cell, it goes down the T-tubule, stimulates the sarcoplasmic reticulum to release calcium into the myofibril. All right, but since this is an exam figure, you got to know what the different parts of this sarcoplasmic reticulum is, right? So here's a T-tubule. What's the function of that T-tubule? It sends something inside the cell. What is it sending inside the cell? I don't know if I'd say calcium. It sends an electrical signal. It sends that electrical signal deep inside the muscle cell, and that electrical signal causes the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So here we have some narrow tubes of sarcoplasmic reticulum. We got some of these big, broad parts of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. These are what we call the terminal cisterns that contain a lot of calcium. So if we put a couple terminal cisternae together with a transverse tubule, we call that a triad. So the triad are the two terminal cisternae that are very, very close to this T-tubule or transverse tubule. All right, so now we got a lot of calcium flooding this myofibril right here. How on earth does that work? All right, let me go to maybe a video right here. I think that's big enough for you to see. Well, let's kind of review what we're seeing on this slide right here. All right, what's the zigzag line right here? Yeah, the Z-disc, which is what? Which is really what? What is that Z-disc? That's the end of a sarcomere, right? That's the end of a sarcomere. So a sarcomere goes from Z-line to Z-line or Z-disc to Z-disc. Remember, it's really a three-dimensional thing. What protein is attached to the end of a sarcomere? Okay. What are the two kinds of myofilaments? Let's start there. What are the two kinds? Actin and myosin. Which is the thick one? Myosin. All right, so here is the myosin molecule right here. That's in the middle of the sarcomere. And then on the ends, this is where we have actin. Now, I know what you're looking at. You're saying, well, this one looks thick now compared to this one. Yeah, they didn't quite draw it right on the video. But the beauty of the video is what? It's going to move, right? So we're going to watch the motion of this thing in just a second. All right, so actin is attached to the Z-line. Here's the myosin. Here are the myosin heads that can grab hold of the actin molecule. And when calcium enters this area right here, right, the actin and myosin are going to slide past each other because this myosin group is going to bend. It's going to pull on an actin. And which way is this actin going to move? It's going to be pulled to the center, right? All right, so here is what we call the A-band. Why do we call this the A-band right here? Because underneath a microscope, it looks like a dark band. And then here is an I-band. Why do we call that the I-band? Because it looks like it's a lighter color underneath a microscope. So when the sarcomere contracts and the Z-lines get pushed together, guess what band disappears? Is it the I-band or the A-band? The I band is going to disappear, right? And this H zone is going to go away. So the I and H go away, and you're left just with the A band. So let's see if I can get this started right here.
And myosin myofilaments lie side by side.
Yeah.
And the H zones and I band are at maximum width. During contraction, the actin and myosin myofilaments interact. The actins are pulled toward the center of each myosin myofilament. As a result, the sarcomere shortens. In the fully contracted muscle, the ends of the actin myofilaments overlap, the H zones disappear, and the I band becomes very narrow.
All right, and the A band remains unchanged. Okay, so there are links in Blackboard, so you can look at this video over and over and over again if you want to. All right, let's take a look at this one right here.
During contraction of a muscle, calcium ions bind to troponin. This moves tropomyosin out of the way and uncovers binding sites for myosin on the actin myofilaments. ATP and phosphate are attached to the myosin head from the previous cycle of movement. The myosin head attached to the exposed binding sites on the actin myofilaments to form cross bridges, and the phosphate is released. Energy stored in the head of the myosin myofilament is used to move the head. This causes the actin myofilament to slide past the myosin myofilament. The ATP is released from the myosin head as it moves. The bond between actin and the myosin head is broken when an ATP molecule binds to the myosin head. The ATP is broken down to ADP and phosphate, releasing energy, which is stored in the myosin head and will be used later for movement. The head of the myosin molecule returns to its upright position and is ready to bind to actin again. If calcium ions are still present, the entire sequence is repeated.
So these myosin heads pull actin right past the myosin molecule. All right, so ATP is the necessary energy source for that, and the signaling molecule is this calcium ion right here. So when calcium, where does this calcium come from? What organelle stores calcium inside? That's the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and when there's an electrical signal, the sarcoplasmic reticulum releases calcium. All right, and that binds to this little troponin molecule right here, so myosin can interact with actin, and they slide over each other, causing what? The Z discs to come closer together. So this I band right here disappears, the dark band stays about the same length, right? And that H zone disappears as well because the actin molecules are being pulled closer and closer together. Okay, so those are some pretty nice little videos that show the sliding filament mechanism. All right, so what else do we have for an important exam figure? Well, you got the neuromuscular junction. Right, remember, calcium has to come in. And then you've got I don't see it right. Ah, here. Okay. And you've got this diagram right here that shows the different myofibrils within a skeletal muscle cell. And this is, here's an organelle that's making ATP. What would you name this guy here? That's the mitochondria. And what's the job of this organelle right here? Stores calcium. And what's the job of this? You could consider this an organelle. What's the job of this organelle right here? Yeah, it sends the electrical signal from the plasma membrane deep down inside the muscle cell so that the sarcoplasmic reticulum can release calcium so that actin and myosin can slide past each other. All right, the other thing that you see on this slide is, what's the name of the connective tissue sheath that surrounds the whole muscle cell? The endomysium. Oh, it's not shown here either. Ah, I got it. Okay, make sure you know where that endomysium is, right? It surrounds the muscle cell. Okay, so I think that's all I want to show. Oh, we got to talk about some other kinds of muscle. Okay, so we're done talking about skeletal muscle. So here is a nice picture of skeletal muscle, right? And here we have cardiac muscle. Cardiac muscle is, each cell is relatively short. It only goes from an intercalated disc to the next intercalated disc, right? So it's really short. There's really only one nucleus per cell. And cardiac muscle is a lot different in how it contracts. So for instance, this biceps right here, when it contracts, let's just say I have a 50-pound weight. Here's a 50-pound weight right here. And here is a coffee cup that's not even a pound, not even half a pound. And I'm going to contract my biceps. All right, I'm going to have a drink of coffee. Now, how am I contracting my biceps, weakly or strongly, to lift my coffee cup right here? Good choice. And then to lift this 50-pound weight right here, how am I contracting that biceps? Strongly. How is it that I can contract my biceps either weakly or strongly depending on the load? And as a matter of fact, sometime when you take a physiology course, you'll learn why, all right, when you lift up this coffee cup, you don't like spill it all over yourself thinking that it's really heavy. Okay. But how is it that that biceps can grade the contraction to be strong or can be weak depending on the weight that you're trying to lift up? What's happening inside your biceps right here? Maybe you're only contracting a few muscle cells to lift up the lightweight, but to lift up the heavyweight, you're contracting maybe all of the muscle cells in that biceps right there, right? Depending on the number of motor units that are being recruited. So that's a really nice thing about skeletal muscle. It can adjust itself. Now, with cardiac muscle, there is a big difference. When the heart contracts, do you want just a part of the heart to contract, or you want the heart to contract weakly, or would you like the heart to contract as a single unit with sufficient force to pump blood? Okay. Yeah, maybe another good example is, maybe I can do this at the same time. All right, let me use my left biceps to lift a heavyweight and my right biceps to lift a lightweight. Can we do that? Oh, wow. I didn't sprain an ankle. All right, so I'm using two different muscles at two different energy levels, two different loads. All right, but the heart can't work like that. The heart has to, guess what the heart has to do? It has to pump and it has to contract as a unit every single time. Part of the heart can't, say, contract and the other part relax. All right, it's not designed to do that. Okay, so the reason why is because in these intercalated discs right here, there are little, what we call gap junctions that allow electricity to go from one muscle cell to the next, through these gap junctions, so that if one muscle cell gets stimulated to contract, guess what happens to the whole heart? The whole heart contracts, right? Because the electrical signals can jump from one cell to the next, to the next, to the next. Unlike skeletal muscle cells. Okay, if this skeletal muscle cell gets told to contract, the ones on either side do not automatically contract, right? Because there's no electrical connection between them, right? And cardiac muscles have those electrical connections that we call gap junctions, so that if one muscle cell contracts, the whole heart contracts. Now, you see, skeletal muscle is long and narrow. What can you tell me about cardiac muscles? They're short, but what else? They're branched, right? So if you start with an electrical signal up over here because of the branching pattern, what happens to that electrical signal? It goes all the way across the heart wall, right? It starts at a superficial region and goes all the way down to the deeper regions because of these branched cells right here. So not only does the whole heart contract, but the superficial layer contracts, and that causes the deep layers to contract because of this branching pattern. See, there are pathways that can go up and down throughout the thickness of the heart wall. All right, and then the third kind of muscle cell we have right here, this is smooth muscle. Now, you don't see that it has a sarcomere. We don't see the striations in a smooth muscle cell like we do with cardiac and smooth muscle, but it still does have actin and myosin. And how would you explain how actin and myosin work together to cause a muscle cell to contract? Actin and myosin do what with each other? They slide past each other. So actin and myosin still slide past each other in a smooth muscle cell, but a little bit different orientation, a little bit different way. All right, so how is that so? All right, so here's a smooth muscle cell. Okay, it kind of just looks like a stretched out football right now. And let me get this a little bit bigger. That's not bad. Let me make it a little bit bigger still. All right, right on the surface of the cell, there are these spots right here that are called dense bodies. And attached to the dense bodies right here, so these dense bodies are attached to the cell membrane. And attached to dense bodies are these dark filaments, these dark thick filaments. What are those dark thick filaments called? Myosin is the thick one. Okay. And in between the dark thick filaments, there are some these lighter filaments right here. Those are the actin filaments. Right? Now, you don't have the actin attached to the Z-discs like you do in skeletal and cardiac muscle. You have it attached to these dense bodies. But here is something similar. When calcium enters the smooth muscle cell, guess what happens to actin and myosin? They start to slide past each other, and when they do, these dense bodies get pulled closer together. So the Z-discs don't get pulled closer together because a smooth muscle cell doesn't have them, but they have these dense bodies that gets pulled closer together. So here you see an example of a smooth muscle cell that is not contracted or relaxed. And then over here you see a picture of a smooth muscle cell that is shortened or contracted because these dense bodies are being pulled closer together. So the actin and myosin form like a net or a mesh on the outside surface of the cell that gets shrunken down, all right, and that causes the smooth muscle cell to contract. So that's a pretty big difference between cardiac and skeletal muscle and smooth muscle. So you should know something about these dense bodies, but that the contraction is still due to the same basic mechanism, and that is that actin and myosin slide over each other. Okay, so that's a really nice example of smooth muscle. See if I close that, what happens to it. Okay, so I think we're done with this chapter. Now, think of some questions. This chapter is not on the test. So if you don't have any questions now, you got to study and then ask me in a week from today. Okay, but you can use some of your online exercises to help you understand some of these things. All right, so we're going to move on to the next chapter, which is chapter 11. Okay, anybody have any questions? What about questions for the test? Anybody got any questions for the test? No? Okay. Good. All right, so skeletal muscle. What are some functions of skeletal muscle? What did you learn about skeletal muscle so far? The main function is that it contracts, right? But what does skeletal muscle really do for us? It's important for movement, for motion. But even if you're not moving, are you contracting muscles? Yeah, for balance and posture. Yeah, I didn't mention balance, but I like that. Yeah, for balance and posture. Right, for heat generation, for instance. Right, so muscles are important for a lot of different reasons. Right, so now let's look at some different structures of different kinds of muscles. Right, and what's a fascicle again? What's a fascicle again? How are you going to conceptualize a fascicle? Yeah, it contains very many muscle fibers, and if you have a muscle organ, the fascicles are the building blocks for the muscle organ, and they go from one end of the muscle to the other. And I think we defined what the two ends of a muscle were. What are the two ends of a skeletal muscle? You've got the origin and the insertion, right? So one end of the muscle doesn't move very much, but the other end moves a lot. It contracts a lot. Which one moves the most, the origin or the insertion? Yeah, the insertion. That's good. That's just a good review. All right, so a lot of times we're going to understand muscles by the orientation of the fascicles that make up the organ. All right, so if a muscle is circular, we're going to call that an orbicularis muscle. And we've got a couple orbicularis muscles on our face. All right, so what kind of structures do you have on your face that are kind of circular? eyes are kind of circular. There's a circular muscle around your eyes that allows you to close your eyes. That is the orbicularis oculi. All right, but that's not the one I have on this slide. I have the orbicularis oris, which is a circular muscle around your lips, around your mouth, right? And that's very important. All right, what's the importance of the orbicularis oris muscle? Orbicularis oris is for chewing so that you don't starve to death, right? Because if you didn't have an orbicularis oris muscle, as soon as you were to chew down on something, what would happen to food? It would come spitting out of your mouth, right? And you would not thrive if you couldn't swallow food, right? All right, so orbicularis oris is important for that particular reason. All right. So here are a bunch of muscles and named by the arrangement of fascicles. So here we see orbicularis, which is a circular muscle. Ooh, I might have to close some of these down. All right, some muscles have parallel fascicle arrangement. All right, these kinds of muscles can shorten a lot. They can contract a long distance, but they're not very strong. All right, so what are some examples of strap-like muscles? All right, so here is one right here that we have in our neck. This is the sternocleidomastoid. All right, and another one where we see the parallel fascicles right here. This would be a good example of the biceps brachii. Other kind of fascicle arrangement that we see right here, for instance, when they're converging to a single point, like the pectoralis major muscle. Right, pectoralis major means that it maybe doesn't contract a long distance, but it's very powerful when it does contract. And then the last kind is the pennate kind of arrangement of fascicles. So there's a central tendon right here, and the muscles, all these fascicles, insert into the central tendon. So this is what we would call a unipennate muscle that we have for a muscle that contracts our thumb. All right, so this muscle, again, doesn't contract over long distances, but it's a very strong muscle. The rectus femoris that we have in our leg right here is what we call bipennate, because here is the central tendon, but we don't have fascicles just on one side. We have fascicles on both sides of that central tendon. So this muscle is even stronger. All right, and then another example of a pennate kind of muscle is the deltoid on your shoulder, top of your shoulder right here. We call this a multipennate. So there are many central tendons with fascicles on either side. Again, this muscle contracts the least amount of distance, but it is one of the strongest muscles, okay, to move your arm. So we've got parallel arrangement, all right, convergent like the pectoralis, unipennate, bipennate, and multipennate, and then we've got the circular kind right here. Let's talk about interactions before we start talking about nomenclature, how muscles, how they function in the body. Okay, so we have a number of different categories. We've got synergist muscles, we've got a prime mover, we've got antagonist muscles, and then we've got fixators. All right, so synergist muscles are muscles that work together to perform the same kind of motion. And some examples of these would be, for instance, in your anterior arm. The biceps is right there, but there's also a muscle that's deep to the biceps. We call that the brachialis. And when they contract, right, what's the motion that happens when the biceps contracts? Flexion at the elbow, or you could say flexion of the forearm. The brachialis does the same job. When it contracts, it causes flexion of the forearm. So these both work together to cause forearm flexion. Since they perform the same motion, we call those synergist muscles. Okay? And usually, if you have a number of synergist muscles working together, there's one that's stronger than all the rest. Yeah? The sign-in sheet? Yeah, I'll start passing around real soon. Real soon. Let's start over here and then we'll pass it down this way. All right, so if you have a bunch of muscles performing the same function, working together, one is usually the strongest. And the strongest one of the group is what we call the prime mover. All right, and in terms of forearm flexion, your book, I think, says the biceps is, and it kind of says it kind of casually, but most people really agree that the brachialis is the muscle, the prime mover for forearm flexion. And so that's really what I want you to know. So sometime in lab or in your book, make sure you take a look at that brachialis. Make sure you can point it out because that's the prime mover. It's the one doing most of the work when you flex your forearm. All right, well, here's that most important concept in the class again, and that is antagonism. Right, so it's really important for you to be able to move some part of your body, like forearm flexion, but it's more important for you to be able to flex with control so that you can actually control where your forearm is moving, how fast it moves, and in what direction. And in order for that to happen, you need antagonistic muscles. So a definition of an antagonistic muscle is one that works, or those two muscles that work in opposition to each other. All right, so they have an opposite effect. And the good example right here, the two muscles are the biceps brachii and the triceps brachii. So the biceps is for forearm flexion, and the triceps is for forearm extension. All right, so these are antagonistic muscles. So in order, this is probably the most helpful thing for you to understand in terms of muscles in the body, and that is, where are the biceps and the triceps located? Where's the biceps located? Anterior arm, okay, it's going to cause flexion. And the triceps is located, oh, we went over this already, in the posterior arm, the opposite body compartment. So if you have muscles in opposite body compartments, what's going to be their relationship? Are they going to be synergistic muscles or antagonistic muscles? Antagonistic muscles. So that's a real important concept. All right, we're going to look at a number of different muscles that way. Fixators are kinds of muscles that really don't produce a lot of motion in your body, but they hold a bone in a stationary position so that other muscles that are attached to it can work properly. And a really good example of this, for instance, is a bone that makes up the pectoral girdle. What are the two bones that make up the pectoral girdle? The scapula and clavicle, right? And which one is directly attached to your upper appendage? Is it the clavicle or the scapula? Scapula, yeah, what does a scapula have that attaches to the humerus? Yeah, it's got that glenoid cavity, right? So in order for you to move your arm, whether you do this, which is, this is abduction or adduction, in order for you to abduct or adduct, or to flex or extend your arm, your scapula has to be held in position, right? The scapula should not be moving around. So there are muscles that hold the scapula in position, and we call those fixators. So even though they're not really moving, they're holding the scapula so that your arm can move properly. Those are fixator muscles. Okay. Let's now talk about nomenclature. So again, this is going to help you learn the names of muscles really nicely, because if you know nomenclature, you don't have to memorize every particular muscle. If you can understand something about a muscle by just knowing its name, or location, or shape, right, that's going to help you out a lot. Okay, so sometimes we name muscles by their location, right, which is one of the reasons why we looked at different body regions and knowing specific names for body regions. All right, for the brachialis, for instance, that's in the brachium, right, or your anterior arm. Intercostals, costa means ribs. Okay, so intercostals are where? Inter between the ribs. All right, so those are important. Sometimes we name muscles by their shape. For instance, the deltoid is a triangular shaped muscle on your shoulder, top of your shoulder, because it looks like a delta or a triangle. All right, another way that we name muscles sometimes is by their relative size. So you might have a group of muscles in a certain part of your body, and one is a big one is a medium-sized one, and one is a really small one. One's kind of dinky. All right, so a good example of these would be the gluteus muscles. Like gluteus maximus is the big one. Gluteus minimus is the small one in that same body region. All right, but sometimes we name muscles by not just how big or small they are, but how long they are. All right, so for instance, the longest muscle, maybe controlling your fingertips or your wrist, is going to be called the longest, but there's also another synergist in that area that's very, very short, so we're going to call that the brevis muscle. All right, so relative size is very important. Sometimes we name muscles by the direction of fascicles. For instance, rectus abdominis means that rectus just means straight. So there are going to be some straight muscles in your abdominal region. All right, and you can see those in a lot of people. They just go straight, what? Anterior, posterior. Those are very superficial muscles that you can see. All right, and what does oblique mean? Oblique means at an angle. At an angle to what? Superior, inferior, or at an angle from left to right, or at an angle from anterior to posterior. So oblique means it's going to be at an angle. And we have some of those external oblique on the sides of our abdominal cavity. That's going to be at an angle. All right, but here is probably one of the most important and easy and great things to know about naming of muscles, okay? And this is by the attachment points. So for instance, what are the two ends of a muscle called again? Origin and insertion. A lot of times muscles are named by their origin and insertion. And the origin is always at the first part of the word, and the insertion is going to be the second part of the word. And in anatomy, we can take different words and put them together as long as we do what? And it makes perfect sense. You got to put an O between them. Okay? So let's look at this first muscle right here, sternocleidomastoid. That seems really intimidating, but this is probably going to be your favorite muscle because by knowing some nomenclature, it's going to tell you what the origin and insertion is, and then you know even the action of this particular muscle. All right, so where's the sternum? Right here, that's your breastbone. And is that going to be the origin or insertion of this particular? That's the origin, all right? And cleido means clavicle. Where's your clavicle? Here's your clavicle, and here's the sternum. Those are the origins of a muscle, of this particular muscle that we're talking about. And then mastoid, that refers to the mastoid process. Where's the mastoid process at? Yeah, it's right behind your earlobe. So here's a muscle that goes from your sternum and clavicle up to your mastoid process, so that's in your neck right here, all right? And when that muscle contracts, what part moves, origin or insertion? Insertion. The insertion, and where is the insertion? Your head. So when that muscle contracts, guess what moves? Does your sternum move or does your head move? Your head moves. And in particular, when that muscle contracts, what's that motion called besides yes?
Flexion.
Yeah, flexion. That's going to cause flexion of your cervical spine or flexion of your neck if they both contract. But if only one contracts, guess what happens? Then that's a what? That's a no, right? Or that's a rotation. So the sternocleidomastoid is really nice because it tells you the origin insertion, so you might get that one on the test. What's that? 3 points on the test, a practicum or whatever. You know the action because you know the origin insertion because muscles always do what? Do they push or do they pull? They always pull, right? So it's going to pull the mastoid process down to the clavicle or the sternum. All right, so many muscles are really nice to know because the origin and insertion is just a part of the name. All right, some other muscles are named by the number of origins that they might have. Like the biceps has 2 different origins. The triceps has 3 different origins, and the quadriceps has 4 different major parts to that muscle. All right, so we're going to look at those. And then a lot of muscles are also named by maybe a combination of these terms, which might also include the action. Like a flexor is going to do what? Decrease the angle between a couple bones. Or an extensor is going to increase the angle. An adductor is going to bring something toward midline, and an abductor is going to move some part of your body away from midline. So I could give you the name of this muscle right here. And you should be able to tell me a lot about this particular muscle. What can you tell me about this muscle? Extensor carpi radialis longus. All right. What's the action? Extend. Extend what? Where do you find carpals? In your wrist. So what's wrist extension look like? Like that? That's hyperextension. But extension would be going like that. All right. Radialis, where are you going to find it? It's going to be on the lateral side of your forearm. And which one is it? Is it the dinky one or the long one in there? It's the long one. All right, so just by looking at the name, you got all the answers for the test for that particular muscle, right? So extensor carpi radialis longus, you know about where it is, what its action is, what the origin and insertion is. So that's really handy just by knowing nomenclature. Okay. All right, well, there's probably some things you got to know for the test. What do I want to show you here? Okay. This is going to correlate to the last part of the text slide that I have for you, and that is to know muscle action by body compartment. So here we have an upper appendage and a lower appendage. And this is nicely color-coded. I can't tell the colors right here. But for instance, this is going to be the anterior arm. This is the posterior arm. And what can you tell me about these two colors? Are they the same color?
No.
No, good. Hopefully not the same color. What's this one here? Pink and? Okay, pink and orange is brown. Okay. All right, so they got different colors. Now, what the heck does that mean? They're in different opposite parts of the arm, but it also means that they have antagonistic motion. They have the opposite motion. So the flexors in the arm, like the biceps brachii and brachialis, are over here, but the extensors are going to be in the opposite body compartment, for instance, like the triceps brachii. All right, so one is for flexion, the other is for extension. In the forearm, you have an anterior compartment that is important for flexion of the wrist, flexion of the fingers as well, right? So anterior forearm is for flexion of the wrist, flexion of the forearm. Where would you find extensors for the wrist, extensors for the digits? The posterior, yeah, posterior forearm, okay? So by knowing location, you should know what the action is. All right, let's go down to the leg. We've got flexors in the thigh for the leg. All right, so when these contract, what happens? You lift your foot up off the ground. That's flexion. Okay, how do you get your foot back on the ground? Okay, to get to, well, close, but we're still just talking about the leg. Get your foot back on the ground, you have to extend. All right, so the flexors for the leg are in the posterior thigh, but the extensors are in the anterior thigh. So they're opposite body compartments. Now I want to talk about dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. All right, in the posterior leg, when these contract, that's going to poke your toes into the ground. What's that called? Plantar flexion, poking your toes into the ground. Now, in order to lift your toes up, you have to exercise the opposite body compartment, namely the anterior muscles right here. That's going to cause dorsiflexion, right? Plantar flexion, dorsiflexion are opposite. All right, so just always go to the opposite body compartment. And your book also has another good... where is it? Down over here someplace? Some other good examples. Let's look at this right here. All right, so we've got, what kind of sections do we have right here? Coronal? Sagittal, what kind of section is this? A nice transverse section of the arm. Okay. And so let's zoom in to this region right here. And so what can you tell me about this region here and this region right here? Okay. Yeah, but and it kind of looks to me like there's different colors right here. Right? Okay. So this right here is posterior. This is anterior. Right? And all of the anterior muscles are flexors. All the posterior muscles are extensors. All right, and so what we see is the biceps brachii and the brachialis. These are both flexors. So how would you talk about these two muscles right here? Are these antagonists or synergists? Yeah, they're synergists for forearm flexion. And then in the posterior compartment, we have the triceps. So how would you describe the relationship between the triceps and the brachialis right here? They're different colors, they have different functions, namely that they are antagonistic to each other. Okay, so it's really important for you to know actions of muscles by body compartment. And that's really handy because when you come and take a test, what do you bring with you? You bring all your muscles, you bring all your biceps and triceps, right? So you can actually be dancing around during the test and maybe even answering some of those questions. All right, so that's the arm. What else do we have right here? Forearm. Okay, so the flexors are going to be in the anterior forearm and the extensors are going to be in the posterior forearm. And now we're in the thigh. Just a little bit different, okay, but we still have, okay, in the anterior thigh, we have extensors, right? That's like when you try to kick a ball, that's extension. And then in the posterior thigh, you have the flexors. What's flexion? Lifting your foot off the ground like this, right? That's flexion, right? Which muscles do you think have to be stronger? The muscles that lift your foot off the ground or the muscles that prevent you from collapsing? Which would be what? What am I doing right now? I'm using the extensors to keep my legs straight. Those have to be a lot stronger than the one that just has to pick your foot up, right? So the hamstrings or the flexors are pretty weak compared to all of these muscles right here that are for extensors. Now you have this medial compartment right here. And these muscles, do these look just by the surface area or the number of them, how do these look? Stronger compared to the flexors or weaker? Stronger. And why is that? Because when you're standing on your two legs, like my two fingers right here, your weight is pulling down, and in order for you to stand, you don't want your legs to do what? Separate, and then you'd fall right between your legs. All right, so these muscles right here are called adductors, and they're very strong to keep your legs underneath you. You maybe never thought of it like that. All right, so here we have extensors in the anterior thigh, flexors in the posterior thigh, and then adductors in the medial thigh. All right, so it's really important to know muscles by their body compartment, which is this last bit right here. All right, so make sure for next time you know what action is produced by what body compartment. Like the anterior neck, we talked about anterior neck causes flexion, posterior neck is extension, anterior abdominal, flexion, posterior, extension. All right, so it's going to be really simple to know that. Where's the sign-in sheet at? Raise your hand if you got the sign-in sheet. It's still going around? Okay, find your name. Sign it really fast.